from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn what the future of renewable energy growth looks like in Wisconsin. Then our Thin Ice series explores how whitefish have been affected by Wisconsin's warming winters and other environmental changes.
You know, just kind of the fundamental way the lake has worked has changed. And, you know, that is a challenge, especially for little fish.
And as Milwaukee Bucks fans tune in for another NBA season, we learn what contributes to a successful free throw.
It's one thing to be standing in your driveway shooting repetitively, and it's another thing to be standing in front of 17,000 screaming maniacs in the Fiserv Forum with the game on the line.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The leader of Wisconsin's largest renewable energy advocacy group says the state was successful in expanding clean energy last year. Sam Denisky from Renew Wisconsin points to two large-scale solar projects in southeast and southwest Wisconsin as examples. But things could look very different this year. The Trump administration has paused federal funding for some renewable energy initiatives, threatening the growth of cleaner energy nationwide. But Denisky says despite uncertainty in Washington, D.C., he feels good about the outlook for clean energy in Wisconsin this year. He joins WUWM's Chuck Wernbach to explain more.
We're optimistic about what will happen this year with renewable energy development. A lot of developers are still very keen in pushing projects forward in our state. We have the first wind project before the Public Service Commission in many, many years. So I continue to remain optimistic. A lot can happen between February and the end of the year, but we're definitely seeing the market pushing renewable energy forward.
So that's on generation, but there's a federally funded effort in Wisconsin that's now uncertain future for it, Solar for All, which was supposed to help people with lower incomes have more access to solar. Federal government may be freezing that. We're not quite sure. Would that be a blow to renewable energy in Wisconsin?
The future of Solar for All is still a bit uncertain. We'll have to see certainly how that plays out. I don't think that renewable energy development in our state is solely dependent on Solar for All. I think it would give it a huge boost to the renewable energy sector in several different areas. But the market is still growing, especially for solar in our state. And I think that Solar for All will 100% help, but developments will still continue on regardless of how long it takes to find clarity on what's happening with the Solar for All program.
And that may take a few months in the courts, depending on what the Trump administration gets in the way of spending freezes and so on. He's also, though, frozen now this EV charger money for Wisconsin, just as three or four stations, mainly in western or northwestern Wisconsin, have started operating with these federally funded chargers. How do you view this federal EV charger freeze?
So much like Solar for All, the federal, they're called the NEVI funds, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Funds. There's uncertainty there. As you pointed out, three projects in western and northwestern Wisconsin have already been completed. There are an additional 33 projects which are still under contract to be built and to receive those funds. So we certainly hope and expect that those contracts will be honored and those projects will be built, but it is certainly causing uncertainty for our electric vehicle charging network, which is unfortunately a bit behind some of our other states. Last year, Wisconsin finally had legislation that standardized public charging by the kilowatt hour. That legislation enabled public charging by the kilowatt hour, which Wisconsin did not have previously. So not only did it enable us to access these NEVI funds, but it also put us much more on par with our neighboring states as well. And so we're playing a little bit of catch up in our state, which is why having these funds delayed or clawed back would have a much more significant impact on Wisconsin, and more specifically on rural parts of the state. I think in some of the bigger population centers along some of the interstates, there will still be investment in fast charging. So when we talk about EV public charging, we're mostly talking about level three charging, which is the really fast charging. I think there will still be investment in that in the more populated areas, but that without those funds to go towards a more widely distributed EV charging network, I think some areas, specifically in rural parts of the state, unfortunately, are going to be left behind.
And remind us of how you see the public benefits of these chargers.
So electric vehicles, of course, don't have any tailpipe emissions. So the vehicles themselves are emission free. Of course, the way they are charged, that is where we have to look at where emissions come from. So currently, Wisconsin has a pretty highly dominated fossil fuel mix in our grid, which means that, you know, those emissions count towards electric vehicle emissions. But as our grid gets cleaner, as we put more wind and solar on our grid, the upstream emissions are going to go down even more. So even as it stands with our current grid mix, it is better from an emission standpoint to be driving an electric vehicle than it is to be driving an internal combustion vehicle.
We've been talking about what's happening at the federal level, but what about state legislation that might help renewables or cleaner energy?
I know Renew and our renewable energy advocates are concerned with three kind of topic areas. And the first one is community solar. We do not have community solar legislation in our state. Community solar is a nice middle ground between the very large utility scale renewable energy projects and things like rooftop solar. We need an all of the above approach, and community solar allows us to do that. It also allows people who cannot install their own rooftop solar to become part of a community solar project where they can buy, it's usually shares of a project, and then they can reap the renewable energy benefits and the economic benefits that way as well. The second subject area that Renew and our advocates are looking at is what's called an integrated resource plan. So we're seeing a lot of proposals for new gas plants, new generation in general. We have a lot of load growth that is expected, in fact, to come onto the grid in the near future. But these energy investments are very significant, right? So we know load growth is happening in our state, but we need a more holistic planning process, because these electric generators are our major long-term investments. So we need to evaluate our entire system, not just individual projects or individual approaches.
So the evaluation would include looking at We Energy's proposed natural gas power plant also in the town of Paris?
So what an integrated resource plan would do is it would have utilities look at their entire portfolio and what they might need, what they might want to retire, things like that. So the individual project applications and projects would still happen, but they would be viewed through this integrated resource planning lens.
Okay, and I interrupted you. You were going to talk about the third sort of major state bit.
Yeah, and then the last item that we are keeping an eye on is we've already seen one bill introduced that would change how large renewable energy projects in our state are sited. So we're looking to make sure that we don't go backwards in terms of our siting process. Wisconsin actually has a very favorable siting environment, but it is still a very thorough and rigorous process. It has to go before the Public Service Commission. It has to be looked at by the DNR, and it has to be looked at through an environmental assessment as well. So we do not want to stall progress in our state by putting up lots of red tape that would make it hard for developers and for utilities to bring more renewable energy projects online more quickly.
I think the Republican authors of that, from what I've seen in a press release, are talking about, well, there's not enough local control over these projects.
I would have to disagree with that. These permits, counties and local municipalities still have a big say in the process. A lot of those projects can be worked out between developers and local governments, and also those entities can certainly weigh in at the Public Service Commission, and the Public Service Commission will always take a much closer look at what a municipality or a county has to say in these regards. So I am concerned, however, that this bill specifically calls out wind and solar projects. There's not any mention of gas projects or coal projects, for instance. So I'm not sure why wind and solar is being specifically identified in this bill, but that's our area of concern.
So we're talking a little bit about Republican philosophy about siting and so on, but you know, in general, they often talk about too much government spending, that private sector should lead initiatives in the way of renewable energy and so on. And Republicans do control the Wisconsin legislature. They control the White House and Congress. What's your basic response to their philosophy, if you will?
Well, I would argue that the private sector is 100% leading this energy transition that we're under. Whether it's EVs, people like to drive EVs because they're quiet, they're fast, they're just, you know, modern vehicles, right? The market also really likes wind and solar development because these projects don't have a fuel cost. So once they're, you know, in the ground, there's the wind and then there's the sun. So these projects are very cost effective, which is why they are attractive both for developers and for the utilities that would like to acquire those resources. So I would argue that the private sector has been leading for quite some time. It's been up against status quo, which is fossil fuel generating plants. And a lot of the federal implements from the Inflation Reduction Act, for instance, were just meant to supercharge this renewable energy transition that we're in. We can clearly see it's happening. All of the major utilities in our state have decarbonization goals. There was a lot of renewable energy investment during the first Trump administration. You look at a state like Texas that has more renewable energy generation of wind than any other state in the country. So this is the idea of renewable energy and clean energy is 100% a bipartisan issue. We're talking about our electric grid here. This is something that everyone uses. Everyone needs electricity in 2025. So it's really important that we make a grid that is reliable, stable, cost-effective, and doesn't contribute to things like public health effects and climate change and whatnot.
Sam Danieski is Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. This week, WUWM is focusing on our warming winters. The State Climatology Office calls winter our most variable season. But how is that variability impacting our fisheries? Today, we'll look at whitefish. These fish are key to commercial fishing on Lake Michigan, and ice fishing for whitefish has become increasingly popular in recent years. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz talks with Titus Seilheimer. He's a fishery specialist with Wisconsin Sea Grant at UW-Madison.
Lake whitefish has been an important food source for, you know, I'd say as when the fish started swimming back into the newly forming Great Lakes, whitefish would have been there. And, you know, the indigenous peoples, you know, would have harvested whitefish. There were, like, historically, there were areas where they would run up the rivers. And so, you know, that's like in the fall, it's one of these few species that spawning in the fall compared to a lot of fish that, you know, ice goes out and they're spawning in the summer. So this, you know, this time of year, right before winter, here's this food source coming up the river or spawning close to shore on kind of rocky reefs. So this accessibility is really important, I think, historically. And then as the Great Lakes were settled and commercial fishing became, you know, a way to feed people and make money, whitefish were, you know, definitely the one of the early, you know, very important fish species. So they were kind of the first to see a decline in their populations because of, you know, a lot of different things happening in the Great Lakes.
Primarily being over-harvesting?
Over-harvest, under-regulate. You know, there weren't a lot of regulations back then, and the regulations they had weren't really followed or enforced. But, you know, a positive story, though, is kind of their reemergence in the recent decades where their populations have come back, and, you know, it is really the kind of backbone of our Wisconsin commercial fishery, and then also becoming a sport fish where people are going out and catching a bunch of whitefish through the ice.
How big can a whitefish, what's the biggest one you've ever seen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some, you know, historic, like, giant, just chunky, super chunky. Like, the ones that I've seen riding on commercial fishing boats, like, the commercial fishery has a 17-inch minimum size. So they have to be longer than 17 inches. And generally, the fish we saw were, like, 20 to 21 inches long. There is kind of a range of how thick they are and how heavy they are, but I'd say like 2 to 2.5 pounds is pretty typical. But, you know, I think, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you would have found some really big lake whitefish out there.
Are they beautiful?
I think they are. I love fish, though, so it's, you know, I'll probably speak up for any species of fish. I mean, they're fairly unassuming. They're just kind of this silvery fish that, you know, large scales, but silver in color and kind of a small head and a small mouth. But then, you know, these big mature adults, they have this like almost this hump on their back. That's all the delicious fillet that you get to eat. So, you know, they may not win any beauty contests, but I think they're great.
So what are the forces at play? I mean, this series, the focal point of these stories we're telling, that our winters are changing. What kind of influence can warmer winters or less ice, less snow mean to the whitefish?
It's sort of their life cycle. Like, they, as a fish that's spawning in November, basically, maybe into early December, they're spawning late in the year. So they are leaving their eggs to kind of overwinter. And that is a strategy for them. Because then in the spring, you know, even like a northern pike is going to spawn right when the ice goes out. But whitefish already have their eggs there. Like, they're fertilized eggs ready to go when conditions are right. So they're, you know, that's a strategy they use. But then just kind of leaving your eggs over winter, especially in these kind of shallower areas or, you know, rockier areas, ice cover can really help protect those from wave action, from, you know, winter storms. Like, and typically in the past, we would have a lot more ice cover on, you know, over these spawning areas, and that would protect those eggs from that, you know, getting disturbed or getting covered up in sediment. And, you know, thinking about, like, if you're a whitefish that goes up into a river and spawns, you're kind of, you know, usually, historically, in the past, you know, our rivers would freeze up mostly, and there would be, you know, the snow builds up, and then there's the spring increase. But, you know, what do we have now? We have variable amounts of snow. We have these, like, all this kind of snow melt that's happening in the winter, which, you know, is kind of a new thing. Like, that is going to affect this environment for those eggs that are, you know, just kind of waiting out the winter in some of these spawning rivers, like the Fox River and the Menominee River. So yeah, those are, you know, impacts kind of at a whole population level, resulting in kind of fewer little whitefish that are able to get to the point to hatch. And then actually we get into the whole food web and quagga mussel things where...
And talk about that a little, because the quagga mussel is, that's another slam on the species and others.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of our kind of big fisheries issues and like challenges to, you know, fish growth and fish populations and, like, you know, things like sport and commercial fishing right now is the changes that zebra mussels and then quagga mussels even more have made to the food web. I mean, there's trillions of mussels out there. They are filtering the algae. And so they're kind of just sucking a lot of the energy in the lake down to the bottom, which if you're an adult whitefish, that's where you feed, because there's less algae, there's less food for these little zooplankton that, you know, so it's like a timing thing. If you're you're one of these whitefish eggs, you know, spring arrives, typically, you know, when the conditions are right, they hatch. And so that's when the clock starts for these little whitefish. They need to find food right away. And the changes in the food web mean that those little whitefish just don't have the food right away. So, you know, that seems to be a bottleneck. You know, if they make it to a little bigger size and they can start feeding on the bottom, they're probably going to be okay. But it is a kind of a challenge for a lot of little fish out in Lake Michigan right now, because, you know, just kind of the fundamental way the lake has worked has changed. And, you know, that is a challenge, especially for little fish. You know, I just talked about, like, the challenges for the whitefish out in the lake, but actually Green Bay is kind of one of the bright spots for whitefish. The return of river spawning just in the last, like, 10 years, like, that hadn't been seen for a century because of, you know, the paper mills and the water pollution, and it just wasn't a good environment. And then all of a sudden these whitefish started going back upstream and spawning in these rivers. And, you know, we talk about the problems with the Fox River and all the nutrient and sediment loading, but, you know, on the positive side, that fertilization in the lower bay does kind of help support these whitefish populations, where they're really doing well in Green Bay. And so this whitefish has emerged, but for the sport fishing side, it is really ice dependent. Their harvest is really limited by the ice and, like, mm-hmm. the ice quality. Like, if you have a bad ice year, there's not going to be a lot of harvest of whitefish from the sport fishery. There's not as much focus on it in management, just because it's kind of this smaller portion of the harvest.
Are there researchers looking at, for instance, whitefish in particular in Lake Michigan, in Green Bay, trying to figure out what is their long-term capacity to make it in the system?
I think there is, from a lot of people, because it's such a valuable species and a species of interest. The DNR in Wisconsin and Michigan, they definitely have a focus on how is the whitefish population doing, what are the challenges, what can we do. They can change things like bag limits or, you know, harvest quotas. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're interested in the native species in the lake, so they're doing things like acoustic surveys on Green Bay and trying to estimate the numbers of, like, little whitefish that are out there. So, you know, using that to understand the robustness of the population. And then there's researchers at the different universities that are, you know, really focusing on things like whitefish movement. You know, this is kind of a great time for scientists, because they're are just, I mean, there's millions of dollars worth of these acoustic receivers in places like the Green Bay and northern, like, Lake Michigan. So they're out there, they just kind of detect these pings that are coming from the tags that are put inside a fish, like whitefish. And, you know, so we're learning about, you know, the timing, like, where do they go? Like, if you catch a fish, you know where it was right then. But what does it do all the other times of the year? So that's, you know, some of this kind of cooperative science that is really, you know, pooling resources to understand. They're, you know, following them through time. They're, you know, actually learning things like, you know, some of the fish that will spawn in the Fox River in Green Bay, they'll actually, you know, they don't just spawn and then leave. They're actually hanging out in the river and spending some of the winter there, because there must be, you know, good food to eat, and then they can head out into the bay later on. So, you know, all things that if you just know, like, okay, fish are caught here at this time and they're caught here at that time, like, you know, you don't know what's happening in the mm-hmm. middle. So, you know, I think there is a lot of focus. And, you know, for us, like, for Wisconsin, in Lake Michigan, like, whitefish are right now 90 plus percent of our commercial harvest. So that is kind of, that's the main game in town. So, you know, the fishermen are interested, the places who, you know, fish markets and all the restaurants in Door County that sell fish, you know, there's a lot of interest in kind of understanding these populations and also maintaining them sustainably into the future.
Titus Seilheimer is a fishery specialist with Wisconsin Sea Grant. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll hear some new songs from local musicians in our Milwaukee Music Roundup. But first, we'll learn about the science behind free throw shooting in basketball. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The free throw is the only time in a basketball game where a player can make a basket without any defensive pressure. Still, many players struggle to consistently make the uncontested 15-foot shot. Despite the rituals that may come before it, the fate of a free throw is set the second the basketball leaves the player's fingertips. And what may seem like a relatively simple element of the game is actually one of the most complex moments a player takes part in, at least scientifically. To find out more about the science behind a successful free throw, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke to William Cullinan, Marquette University's Dean of the College of Health Sciences. He begins by explaining the science behind the pre-free throw ritual.
Anyone who's ever been coached to play basketball is taught to keep that consistent, whatever that ritual is, whether it's bouncing the ball three times, five times, if you're Giannis Antetokounmpo, perhaps 10 times or something wild. But the idea is that you're kind of like accessing a type of procedural memory that's going to allow you to be more consistent as a shooter. In a sense, it's a type of priming.
So what part of the brain is most involved in learning how to shoot free throws in that priming that you're talking about?
Well, it's surprisingly large. So we know that the motor parts of the brain are the brain regions that are responsible for producing motion are most involved. But as it turns out, there's quite an extensive part of the brain that's involved in any kind of complex motor act, like shooting a basketball. And that might come as somewhat of a surprise to folks at first, because we typically think of these functions as relatively segregated. But as it turns out, for a complex motor function, like shooting a free throw, there's a fantastic complexity involved. And in fact, the parts of the brain that are thought to control motor function on the cortical surface are insufficient to be able to do that by themselves. That is, such a wide array of muscles acting to move joints in a very specific sequence is really complicated. And there just isn't enough information processing capacity in our motor cortex alone to be able to pull that off accurately. And so there are a series of parallel channels that the brain uses and accesses, if you will, to program complex motor actions like a free throw.
So this programming of complex actions, is that another term for muscle memory, how we condition ourselves?
Yeah, in a sense. So in a very strict sense, there's no such thing as muscle memory, because muscles don't remember. They do have receptors that report to the nervous system and brain, and therefore we're really talking about the same thing. But it is that feeling that, you know, you're in that groove, you're in that form that you've accessed before. And that type of procedural memory is something that we've all experienced if we've ever ridden a bike or learned any complex motor action with any kind of proficiency. But for me, the critical feature, and there are so many things that have been written about free throw shooting, that is how to improve accuracy with free throw shooting. And I've been somewhat of a student of the game and of that aspect of it for a long time. And, you know, some of the key features of shooting include the velocity of the stroke, if you will, the alignment of it. People talk about putting a little bit of backspin on the shot so that if it is off a little bit, it has a good chance of rolling in. And then, of course, perhaps most importantly, is the release angle. That is the angle above the body that the ball actually leaves the hand or wrist, which is thought optimally to be somewhere between, say, 45 and 55 degrees. And that produces the correct arc so that it's a successful shot. So all of these things are true, but my thesis is a little bit different. And it's this, it's that the stroke or the shot needs to be of an optimal length in terms of the motor program involved in order to be most effective. That is either too short or too long, it predicts inaccuracy.
So all of these kind of complex factors are kind of accumulating in the launch conditions of the shot, right? The instant that ball leaves the player's fingertips, but so much has gone into what is going to take the ball or happen to the ball before that, right?
Yes, and in fact, in neurological terms, what's happened is almost miraculous because the specificity of the neural activity that has to occur within these parallel channels running from the cortex through the brain and then back to the motor cortex are enormously complex. And when I talk about the length or optimal length of the motor program, I'm talking about fully engaging that system. That is not under engaging it and also not having a motor program so long as to allow the introduction of error. And that's a key.
Free throws are the one time a basketball player is not dealing with any defensive pressure, which is a different environment compared to the majority of their playtime on the court. So to people who perhaps haven't played or aren't as experienced, they may think, oh, what's so hard about standing without any players trying to get in your way and make a basket, right? But this is a vastly different condition compared to what they're used to playing in. So how does stress and anxiety impact shooting success?
Yeah, they do a lot. It's one thing to be standing in your driveway shooting repetitively, and it's another thing to be standing in front of 17,000 screaming maniacs in the Fiserv Forum with the game on the line. And so those types of stressful situations certainly have an impact on accuracy. And so, again, stress is something that can lead to the introduction of error into a motor program. So there's a whole psychology behind that aspect of the free throw. That is to put oneself in a zone or perhaps use mental imaging to conjure up a less stressful situation or something more comfortable. And those can always be important factors in accuracy. But you're right, stress and anxiety are certainly factors in free throw shooting. In a sense, there's nothing very free about that.
So do you think the one consistent thing to get a player into that mindset, no matter what the environment is to have that base of practice, and establish your routine? Is that really what's going to make you most successful, is all the work that's done away from the moment where it counts most?
That's certainly a big part of it. But I think another part of it is to practice under differential conditions. So you want to practice when you're exhausted. You want to practice when you're fresh. You want to practice somewhere in between, because those are the conditions under which you'd be shooting them in a game. And if you were only to practice under ideal conditions, say at the start of your workout, again, predicts that you're not going to be ready for that situation late in the game where you're kind of tripping over your tongue as it is, and now have the added stress of winning or losing the game.
Well, definitely fascinating stuff for something that may seem simple on the outside. So, William, thanks so much for telling us more about it.
Happy to be with you.
Dr. William Cullinan is a professor and the dean of the College of Health Sciences at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2022. Coming up, we'll hear some new songs from local musicians in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 2025 has only just begun, but there is already a plethora of new songs from Milwaukee artists. As always, Matt Wild has been listening. Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, and every month he joins us to share some of his favorite new songs from local artists as part of his Milwaukee Music Roundup. Matt, as always, thank you for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
So we're starting off with a new song from an artist who I believe is new to the Roundup, who is talking, though, about a very familiar topic here at WUWM.
Yes. It's the song is called On the News, and it is by a Milwaukee artist, and her name is Ellie Grimm. Definitely new to our Roundup chats, but not new to the Milwaukee music scene. Ellie Grimm previously played in a band, a fantastic band called Honey Creek. And this was kind of a very pop emo band, a really fantastic group. And they were around for a couple of years and they kind of hung things up late last year in 2024. Honey Creek played their final shows. And now Ellie Grimm, who was a singer, multi-instrumentalist for that group, she's come out on her own and has released a pair of songs. She released one last year and now has just released a new one. It's called On the News. And they are very, both of these songs, and especially the one we're going to be listening to today, are very, very different from her work with Honey Creek. This solo work from Ellie Grimm is very, very pop. Very, I would say, like 2000s era pop. I think she describes herself as kind of like an internet-conscious alternative poptimist or something like that, and that sounds good to me. I know she's been playing a lot of shows, solo shows, so you'll probably be able to see her around. So this is Ellie Grimm with On the News.
Shot myself down on the West Coast just to see my face on a brand new post. Hated by everyone I've ever known. Don't play well with others or on my own. Yeah, I just want to take everything that's new and do it first. You could have held my hand, but I'm just the worst. I'll be a pain in your chest, a memory that hurts. When I become the biggest thing on earth, if I want to. Switch up the track, switch out my face. Now I can fit the mold in any space. Your mommy's gonna see me on the news at 8. Get up, give it a brand new name. Switch up the track, switch out my face. Now I can fit the mold in any space. Your mommy's gonna see me on the news at 8.
On the News by Ellie Grimm. Now, I'm not sure if we've actually talked about this next artist, Joey Turbo, previously, but he's definitely a friend of the show. People might know him as one of the former owners of Promises in Walker's Point. He's been in a lot of different bands over the years, but this album itself has quite the backstory.
It absolutely does. This is the latest from Joey. The album, which I can't say in full the name of the album, but it is called Up Against the Wall, and then there's another word. And it is, I believe, his first solo album under kind of his own name, perhaps, in a long time. Joey, as you said, has been around the Milwaukee music scene for a long, long time, most notably in his group Rio Turbo, which were around for like 10 years and kind of hung things up a few years ago. After that, and around the same time, he was part of the Platinum Boys, the fantastic garage rock Platinum Boys, and he's played in a ton of other bands and has just been a Milwaukee treasure, I would call him, for many years. Former owner of Promises, which sadly closed its doors. And this album that he recorded, Up Against the Wall, has it does have kind of a tough backstory. He also had a lot of health problems and some hospital visits over the last year or so. And with the bar closing, it's been a tumultuous year. And this album, as he says kind of in the liner notes, was recorded in his home at Promises and in various hospital rooms. It's a fantastic album. It is definitely, if Rio Turbo, if they were kind of a party pop band, this definitely feels like kind of a hangover record. It is... it's kind of all over the map. There's a lot of great stuff, and he's playing, I think, pretty much all the instruments. The song we're going to listen to is kind of an outlier on it. It's kind of got this weird little country flavor to it. The song is called I Got To, It Got To. It's kind of a song about drinking. It's like, I got to drinking, and drinking eventually got to me. So, yeah, there is definitely kind of a bleary-eyed vibe that goes throughout this record. Some tough circumstances, but a really fantastic album that covers a lot of genres. The song we're going to be listening to, I Got To, It Got To.
I got to drinking, you got to me. It's plain to see, babe, and a man you. I like parties, ain't too much fun. Like sniffing cocaine, like shooting my gun. Nesting a bud in my baby, oh, it's plain to see I got to drinking. Drink got to me. I got to thinking, thinking got to me. Find my power, look to my knees. Real fast women, real sharp men. Where did it start, babe? How does it end? Nesting a bud in my baby. Oh, it's plain to see I got to drinking.
I Got To, It Got To by Joey Turbo. The next song is from an artist that I think we have talked about before. I think it's Matthew, is that right?
I believe so. I think so as well, yes.
It's an interesting mix of genres. It somehow has both of a kind of like acoustic roughshod feel, but it's also very produced.
Absolutely, yes. This is Matthew with his latest single. It is called Oxen. Matthew is the solo project of Kevin Bush, and he, Kevin, is one half of the fantastic Milwaukee electro synth pop group Immortal Girlfriend. His brother is in it, William. He has a solo project called Black Challenger, which I know we've talked about on this show before. Matthew is a little more pop-leaning. This song, Oxen, is it's got I can't take credit for this comparison. This was my Milwaukee record partner, Tyler Moss, said this. It's kind of a mix between In Excess and Bon Iver. I like that. It does kind of have that vibe. But it's really, really fantastic. And I think it's part of an album that he's working on that will be released sometime this year. Also a great video, I might add, with him kind of down on the farm. Kind of a fun video of him playing the song out at a farm. So, fantastic song. It is Matthew with Oxen.
About you all the time.
Oxen by Mathew. The final song we're going to talk about, we're slowing it down a bit. This song is a very alternative indie folk. I also very much appreciate the band's name.
Ah, yes, absolutely. And I'm saving this one for last because I love having a new favorite song so early in the year. And this one was released on New Year's Day, January 1st. This is a song from Next Paperback Hero. The name of the song is Parochial Tween. It is from his album Better Late Than Never. Next Paperback Hero is also a solo project. It is a solo project of Nathan Honore. Sorry if I butchered his name. But Nathan has been around for, again, a number of years, has released a number of records, and I believe he has said, I don't know if this is officially his final Next Paperback Hero record, but he says he's putting the project on pause. Kind of like Joey Turbo, too. I think he performs most of the instruments on this. It's mostly acoustic singer-songwriter. But this song in particular, Parochial Tween, and what I love about it is the songwriting. It's a song about growing up in kind of a Catholic, I assume, school, being a young kid, maybe, you know, in seventh, eighth grade, and just being kind of a lonely, misfit kid and slowly finding yourself playing in a band and finding your friends and just kind of that loneliness of that time in a lot of our lives, I think. And he does it in a very, using very specific lyrics. And you can absolutely pinpoint when this song is set. He mentions things like the new Weezer album is green, reference, of course, to the Green Weezer album that came out in 2001, taping Saturday Night Live on a VCR and watching it the next day and slowly discovering bands, cool bands like Rage Against the Machine and the Pixies and things like this and the White Stripes. So it's set in a very, very specific time. And it's one of those things where even though it's so specific, it somehow makes it more universal. You can kind of sub in, whatever bands and whatever things that were coming up when you were that age. And it still speaks to you. I don't know. I think it's a heartbreaking, lovely little song. One of my favorite songs of the year. So it's Next Paperback Hero with Parochial Tween.
SNL on TV, the new Weezer is green. VCR set to tape, rewatch it day after day. Hip, 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 hip. Uniform doesn't fit, pants are pleated an inch. Hoping for some new shoes, but a new backpack would do. You think you look good in glasses, only wear them in class. Start to spike up your hair anytime, anywhere. Do-do-do-do-do.
Parochial Tween by Next Paperback Hero. Now, it is really just the start of the year still, even though it seems like it's been 2025 for a bit now. But what are you looking forward to in these cold winter months?
I actually like these winter months to kind of wrap my head. I enjoy the fresh start of the whole thing, January and February, especially when it comes to listening and kind of keeping tabs on Milwaukee music. It does feel like a time like, okay, I can just forget about everything that was released last year. We did our best year-end lists, and now we can start fresh. That's all great until, just like I was saying, I suddenly have a new favorite song that was just released this year in January. And I know that's just going to continue throughout the year, and then by June I'm just going to like forget all this stuff, and I'll have to go back. So I'd like this kind of period of time where I can kind of wrap my head around things. But I know by, mid-year, there'll be just so much good stuff that I've forgotten most of it. Though, always go back to these shows and remember all the great music. So thank you for helping me out on this, Joy. It's always appreciated.
That's what we try to do here. Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup. and shares a few of those picks with us. At WUWM.com, you can find our previous conversations all about Milwaukee artists. And that wraps up today's Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with a master electrician transforming homes and lives in Milwaukee. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Go patrol with your crush every day after lunch at the church basement dance. Always stand at the back, wait for the song that you know. Sweaty pits start to show, your dad's guitar in a case, so you settle for bass, load your amp in the